This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.
FUBAR Radio presents Politics on FUBAR.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Asa Bennett, and this is Politics on FUBAR. Now, it's obviously a very difficult week to be talking about politics in the wake of the tragic events in Manchester on Monday night. But nonetheless, I think we should be inspired by what Andy Burnham, the mayor of Greater Manchester, said when he said on the morning afterwards, on Tuesday, that although it was a sad day for Manchester, it very much will be trying to move on. It was sort of as far as normal, it'll be business as usual. And so in the same way, now, as election campaigning sort of gets back into sort of full steam slowly but surely, even then, we cannot escape the tragic events, the sort of terrorist attack in Manchester, as Jeremy Corbyn made clear on today with a speech, trying to imply in this typically Corbynish way that, you know, if only we hadn't invaded so many places, then we wouldn't have to be so much at risk. And obviously the Conservatives say this is a very sort of boorish thing to say, and we're very much in uproar. And of course, Jeremy Corbyn was very keen to get back to the campaign trail because, of course, over the last 3 days, people have speculated on Twitter about what effect the sort of attack and the sort of suspension of campaigning would have had on the election. And there were some sort of Jeremy Corbyn sympathisers who were rather sort of tastelessly, I might say, suggesting that actually this was all very convenient, wasn't it, for Theresa May? You know, so suddenly we can have 3 days of her being Prime Minister and just Jeremy Corbyn being a sideshow as a result. Well, Corbyn is front and centre, and nonetheless he's getting quite a lot of flack today. And so you might think, well, we shouldn't, obviously, when discussing politics, be talking about personalities. Well, rest assured, we're going to be having a lot of interesting personalities lined up in this show, but we'll be focusing on policy, nonetheless, in that sort of, as we examine the manifestos, obviously, many of them have not received much attention, given sort of UKIP only now releasing their manifesto to much uproar and furore. The Conservatives have really come a cropper with theirs, given the social care or dementia tax sort of snafu, meaning that they now find themselves having lost a sort of 23-point poll lead, with YouGov just recently saying that it's about 5 points, really, there ahead of Labour. It's no longer stratospheric. It's no longer a Tory landslide guaranteed. In fact, it seems to be all very competitive, which makes the election race very fascinating indeed. And so, to help examine the issues, I'm delighted to say that we're going to have, an extended interview with Caroline Pidgeon, Liberal Democrat Assembly member, as well as a debate among various panellists of who is the best manifesto for Britain. We're going to have Laura Round from the Bright Blue think tank, as well as Jacob Ferrady, a journalist, and Leonie Cooper, an Assembly member for the Labour Party in London, of course. Now, you might be thinking, gosh, well, what if you're really sort of interested by these sort of points of view that are flung across and you really want to weigh in with your views? By all means, you are very much welcome. You just simply will tweet us at FUBAR Radio, or you can email directly at politics@fubarradio.com, and those opinions will be filtered down to me in the studio. And so, may I just then say, to kick things off, of course, we're going to be speaking to a representative from Operation Black Vote, a very interesting guy called Simon Woolley. But first, before that, we have a clip of party leaders launching their respective manifestos.
This is a manifesto for all generations. We're providing hope and genuine opportunity for everybody. For the last 7 years, our people have lived through the opposite. A Britain for the rich and the elite and the vested interests. They've benefited from tax cuts, bumper salaries, and millions have struggled at the same time. Whatever your age or situation, people are under pressure, struggling to make ends meet. Our manifesto is for you.
I launch my manifesto for Britain's future. A plan for a stronger, fairer, more prosperous Britain. A plan to seize the opportunities ahead and to build a country that our children and grandchildren are proud to call home. It is a detailed programme for government, rooted in the hopes and aspirations of ordinary working people across the land. It is a vision for Britain. A portrait of the kind of country I want this nation to be after Brexit, as we chart our own way in the world.
Giving you the choice over your future is exactly what our manifesto is all about. I want you to change Britain's future. I want you to imagine a brighter future. Imagine a future where our children can grow up in a country where people are decent to each other, where we have good schools and hospitals, where we take the challenge of climate change seriously, where we give our teachers and our nurses and our soldiers the pay rise they deserve for the service they give to our country, where we have an open, innovative economy, where we treat the poorest and the most vulnerable with compassion.
UKIP is the country's insurance policy, and if the government begin to backslide during these negotiations, then it must know that UKIP will be there. It's seldom easy being a UKIPper. Joining an establishment party, would offer a far easier route to preferment. But this party is all about believing in our country and putting it first. It is not the British way to turn a blind eye to evil in our midst.
FUBAR Radio presents Joey
Page. Welcome to the studio, the fabulous Picks. Have you got big plans because you're doing some headline shows? So is that different to what you've just been doing? Or
no, I mean, it's pretty much the same. I've got like a new drummer in my band, which is very nice. Mm-hmm. Never used to have live drums.
So what's your live setup like?
My brother Luke plays with us on stage. He plays guitar.
Older or younger brother?
Older.
Is he keeping you in check?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think I'm keeping him in check.
Really?
I'm like an older brother to you in many ways.
Well, you're just older. Oh,
yeah. Every Wednesday, Joey Page. From 2 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back. It's Asa Bennett here, and it's my pleasure to introduce Simon Woolley, Director of Operation Black Vote. Good afternoon, Simon.
Good afternoon, Asa.
Now, I wondered, obviously, Operation Black Vote, they've released their own manifesto and what they want from the parties, and it's a very interesting document. But then, do you feel that the manifestos from the main parties, have they been satisfying you much? I mean, how are you feeling across the board?
Sure. Well, I'm encouraged about people that are registered to vote for last week's deadline. Literally tens of thousands rallied to our campaign. We used our media friend, Saatchi & Saatchi, and it looks like it was very successful. But now, of course, we've got to use that leverage and make sure that the political parties begin to address the concerns we've outlined in our manifesto. And number one concern is for the next government to have a plan, have a comprehensive race equality strategy right across Whitehall that will begin to close some of those persistent race inequality gaps. For example, you know, 50% of black youth unemployment is at a level three times the national average. And it's not just at the bottom end, you know, where are our CEOs, our generals, our judges? So there's these penalties that need to be brought down to ensure that people are not locked out, Asa, but have a place to fulfill their potential.
Do you think that these concerns are being were answered, though, in the manifestos we've seen?
Well, I mean, there's some movement there. Now, in these last few days, we've got to put our manifestos in front of the leaders and get them to respond. I'm sure we can do that. I mean, of course, you'll know the demographic data shows that in 45 of the 50 most marginal seats in the country, the black and minority ethnic vote could decide who wins and who loses.
Yeah, now that research was really quite fascinating, may I say, because obviously with the Tories have had a historically lot of difficulty trying to appeal to the black vote. I mean, let's talk about Zach Goldsmith, for example, when
that was truly shocking.
His attempt to try and appeal seemed to be what, you know, oh, we're going to steal your jewellery, and it's all sort of, you know, that's the bit, you know, BME strategy sewn up or something. And then Sadiq Khan, obviously, testament to London, you know, romping home. I mean, do you think the Tories are getting any better now? Does the legacy of Goldsmith sort of hang over in a sense?
Well, I mean, that was a legacy, an unfortunate legacy, particularly in the capital as well. I mean, come on. But actually, that Theresa May's got a good backstory, particularly around stop and search, which she's told the Metropolitan Police that they've got to stop this, in effect, racial profiling, you know, that dragnet approach. Mental health she's been good at too. And, of course, Jeremy Corbyn has a long tradition of equality and race equality, so they're all vying. They've all seen this data, because all their officers have been in touch with me and said, is it true? And I said, look at it yourself. It's very, very true, and we're registered to vote, and we're voting. So we've got to drag them. It's a kicking and screaming to our table. But, you know, the upshot of it will be that everybody benefits. First of all, we unleash talent for Britain PLC. And it takes people away from criminality, away from extremism, into the mainstream, in which everybody benefits.
Of course. Although it was interesting you were talking about Theresa May's legacy as Home Secretary, because I remember the UKIP manifesto launch, and I'm sorry for mentioning them, that Suzanne Evans took great pains to say, you know, oh, look, actually the stop and search reduction, that proves she was weak as Home Secretary. And this is why we had the Manchester attack practically. I'm not blaming her, but I am, sort of thing. It was strange.
Yeah, well, I don't care what UKIP say.
Their demise, I imagine. Yeah,
well, too many of them are bigoted. It's a shame they should be even cast as a mainstream organisation with such bigotry. But of course, I think that Theresa May, whilst the Home Secretary, looked at the data and said, actually, this dragnet approach to stop and search doesn't help catch criminals. It alienates the very people that we need on our side to catch criminals.
Of course.
But we need to do more than that, and I think the essence of it, of our manifesto and our core core to the political parties, look, that if you recognize the problem, have a plan to tackle it, then right on your doorstep you have this energy, dynamism, and talent that can take Great Britain to a very, very different, positive place.
But then, if I may say, looking through your manifesto, obviously the demands are, you know, they're very interesting. So post-Brexit Britain must include equal rights for minorities, you know, sort of, obviously being very much a specific offence for online hate and work, is a work, sort of, online hate, pardon me, and working more productively with social media companies, sort of cracking down on hate crime, sort of being good on human rights. Part of me then just thinks, you know, what's wrong with that? Who would disagree with that, in a sense? So, I mean, why would you be worried? Why would you think these are things the parties aren't in danger of ignoring?
Well, we need them written down. We need them written down. We need to get their commitment on these on these issues. And I think what we're particularly asking for is a plan. So yes, they might say yes, we like all of that. But what's the plan to go from A to Z? And without that, it's just an aspiration. Yes, we're all cuddly, we all love each other. Well, you know, when you look at the data, that there's too many obstacles from the bottom end to the top end and to the middle, which locks people out. I mean, I'm sure you'll remember the former Prime Minister David Cameron when he said it is a national disgrace that an African woman has to change her name just to get an interview.
And that was very much part of his social mobility sort of crusade.
It was. So I don't think there's any argument now about acknowledging the structural racial disadvantage that occurs right across. I think the biggest challenge that we're going to have to face is that what are the political parties' plans? And I'm telling anyone that will listen on your station and anywhere else, look, when the politicians come to your door for your vote, which can decide whether they get in or they lose, you use it as a leverage, as a if you like, a £50 note, and say, look, what are you giving me for this?
Of course. I mean, although, imagine when you put forward things like a plan to tackle racial inequality, you know, sort of some conservatives might say, well, hang on, you know, sort of, well, of course we, you know, don't like racism and we don't like racial inequality, but they would point to things like Harriet Harman's, I think, Equality Act, I think 2010, that they would argue was very prohibitive and meant there was lots of, you know, burdens on businesses in a sense. So, I mean, you know, they would qualify their support for you, I imagine.
Well, maybe or maybe not. The fact that the data doesn't lie, and the data suggests that the opportunity isn't equitably dispensed. And so we're saying, look, this is what we think is a plan. If you have another way of doing it, we don't care as long as you do it. But if you don't, here's one.
Of course.
So you throw it back with all the data, and then you say, how are we going to get from this place to this place?
And that's a very interesting, obviously, the vision you're trying to offer the parties, because I can't help thinking of, and I'm sorry to mention this person alongside UKIP, you know, Donald Trump. Whenever he was trying to appeal to black voters during the US presidential campaign, there was the infamous speech where he said, you know, quote, what the hell do you have to lose? And then he kept always sort of, whenever anyone from like the black congressional caucus would ask a question, he would start going about inner cities and poverty, in a way. I imagine you'd think that's very sort of stereotyping, very sort of, you know, hang on, you're just imagining they're all sort of poor people who you'd have to talk down to.
We clearly like global politicians to tackle the poverty that rages amongst many minority communities, both in the USA and here in the UK.
But many voters will be aspirational; they'll be middle class as well.
But you're right. I mean, look, you need to tackle all ends. And actually, with most minority communities, is that we live and breathe on hope and aspiration. And I think what the Conservatives have been on the front foot on, and the Labour Party need to play catch up, is that when Cameron spoke and Theresa May recently, they talked to our communities and appealed to the aspirational side, entrepreneurs, dynamism, creativity, and that gains traction. It's not just doom and gloom, although we want some of those elements to be tackled. We want our children to be lawyers and doctors and who knows, a future prime minister from our communities. Why not, Asa?
I mean, do you think there are any existing sort of politicians from minority background you would personally hope might have a tilt for the top?
No, I do. I think there are a number on both sides, African, Asian, and Caribbean, on both sides.
So Chukwuemeka, Sajid Javid, that sort of thing.
Sajid Javid, exactly. Sam Gimia. I think one to watch would be the young man down in Bristol, the first Caribbean mayor of the first mayor of Caribbean descent in Europe, and that's Marvin Rees. He's definitely one to watch.
Definitely.
And not just because he comes from Operation Black Vote mentoring scheme.
Well, absolutely. He's very, very charismatic, may I say. And so actually, on that sort of positive note, I probably should wind up this interview, but thank you so much for your time, Simon.
We should talk again. I mean, we should talk again. And can I just have this little 10-second platform to say, look, I want all your listeners to use the Democratic franchise. We can make a difference and we can demand for great positive changes in this country.
Excellent. I'm sure they will be gratefully hearing that. And thank you again for sparing the time.
Thank you, Issa.
Bye now.
Bye.
And so that was Simon Woolley of Operation Black Vote. And coming up next, I'll be having an in-depth interview with Labour candidate for Westmorland and Lonsdale, Ellie Aldridge. But first, we took to the streets to find out what the general public think of this year's manifestos. And we asked them specifically this, and this is something that our guests will be considering later in the show. Who has the best manifesto for Britain?
I know a little bit about the Tory manifesto and the Labour manifesto, but I've not read them page to page.
I think the best manifesto for Britain at this moment, the way the country and the world stands, is Conservative. Just the stability, and we don't need to be thrown into any more confusion. They know what they're doing, they're in power. I think it'd be a dangerous thing to change it.
I think the most progressive one is Labour's. I think it won't be an election-winning manifesto, though. I think they've closed the gap this week. There's a YouGov poll today saying they're 5 points between them. But Jeremy Corbyn's announcement on war and foreign wars is a problem, I think. So I think it's become less about a manifesto and more about these bigger narratives at the moment.
I want to vote Labour. I just think their policies are really helpful for the less privileged people in this country, especially with what's going on with like taxes and things, and like rich people aren't paying their taxes properly, and we've got this all these cuts happening with the NHS and everything else. So I think they've got the best policies when it comes to helping the little guys.
Probably Labour, because, well, the Conservatives seem to fuck everything up.
Labour. Why? Because it's for the people and not for the elitist. No, it's not just, you know, cutting things for the elite. It's making it more even and equal.
I would say at the moment they throw everything at you, and weighing it up, I would say I always vote Labour, but I'm swayed to be voted by Conservative. Labour said something about NHS, but I don't believe anything what either of them say.
I would say Labour, I think, because Labour care for the people, or try to care for the people, and I think Conservatives are more aimed at the few more than the many.
Well, that seemed a good diverse range of opinions, and obviously some of them seemed there to be more sort of on the Labour type, and are some perhaps Conservative, Theresa May friendly, we shall see. But nonetheless, I've got the distinct pleasure to welcome Ellie Aldridge to the studio, and he is Labour's candidate in the very fine constituency of Westmorland and Lonsdale. Good afternoon, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Now, for the listeners who don't know the constituency, it is the Cumbria one. It's the Cumbria seat, famous for having representative Mr. Tim Farron, leader of the Liberal Democrats. So, Eli, you're standing for Labour. I mean, what problem do you have with Tim Farron?
Well, I think his party sold young people off the street when going into bed with the Conservatives in 2010 in the coalition government. I think some of the policies they brought through, particularly the tripling of tuition fees, the implementation of the bedroom tax, and the Health and Social Cares Act 2012, all these had a negative impact on young people. And for me personally, as a local who's grown up in the area my entire life, when the opportunity came to represent the party that I love and have been a member for many years, to fight against a party that I feel has let young people down unequivocally, it was a no-brainer for me.
I mean, do you feel that you're getting much of a good response on the doorstep?
Absolutely. So this is, you know, it is a safe Liberal Democrat seat. For me, it's not as much pressure as it could be. So when I'm out on the doorstep, I can speak my mind, and I have a lot of time to spend talking to locals and getting to know what their issues are and what the problems they face in the constituency. And it's been really, really positive. People are very interested in my campaign and the wider Labour Party. I think the manifesto has excited a lot of people, and there's a lot of people want to get involved. A lot of people want to talk about it and want a bit of change in this country and in the constituency as well. And I think the Labour offer the best chance of that.
But are they all really sort of seething about tuition fees there and sort of thinking, my God, you know, you're right, we're definitely going to vote for you, we still remember this stuff? Well, they're not being a good local MP, you know, is there not that going on?
You know, Tim Farron's a very good local councillor, is what I like to think of him as. He gets there, he talks to people, he gets out on the streets. There's a saying that if a crisp packet's opened, he's there to take a picture. But in terms of representing Westmoreland Lonsdale on a global stage, I think a lot of people have got a bit disillusioned and believe that he's putting the Liberal Democrats' interests over their own, particularly on issues such as Brexit. So the constituency voted to remain in the European Union. But it wasn't a decisive victory in this area. It mirrored the results nationwide just opposite. So there is a large proportion in this constituency that voted to leave the European Union who don't feel their local MP is giving them a voice or even wanting to discuss their reasons for voting.
He sort of looks down on them, maybe.
Perhaps, and I think there is a perception of arrogance, perhaps, that he has got too big for his boots and he's off running around the country as a Liberal Democrat leader. And I think a lot of people around here feel a bit left behind by that.
It's the giddy heights of leading a party with just eight or nine MPs, really, you know.
I know.
Can get to him. But it comes to I can't help wondering, of course. We were talking about the doorstep, hashtag Labour doorstep and all that. But does Jeremy Corbyn not come up as a problem for you? Do they not say,
I think there was an issue, but since the campaign started and Jeremy Corbyn's messages got out there for all the people to see, and where they see that his position on Trident hasn't affected Labour policy, and I think that has got through to people. So Jeremy Corbyn does come up on the doorstep, but more often than not, it's in a positive. I'm considering voting Labour for the first time because of Jeremy Corbyn, and this is something I'm hearing a lot on the doorstep, because Jeremy Corbyn, he has divided opinion in the past, but if you look at the polls, he's certainly on the rise, and I think that is mirrored in this constituency.
What has he done to answer people's concerns? Because of course he's still the same Jeremy Corbyn. And what were the original concerns, and how have they changed?
So a lot of people in Cumbria, as you may well know, relies heavily on nuclear energy, and in Barrow the BAE systems, which make the Trident submarines. So when Jeremy Corbyn became leader, and his history is traditionally that he is against nuclear power, nuclear energy, and he's against Trident. So that is something that is brought up. People are concerned about their jobs, perhaps.
It went down badly in Copeland.
I think Copeland was a numerous factors. I think it would be unfair to single that one factor out as the reason for it.
Okay, I'm just being cheeky, fine.
But the manifesto, which has support for Trident, the renewal of Trident in there. There's a commitment to those jobs, and I think that has alleviated people's fears in that sense.
It's curious you're saying that, because of course we've had a tweet from a listener while you've been speaking, a chap called Paul, who says, I personally find Corbyn uninspiring. I certainly wouldn't vote Tory, but as a once proud Labour voter, I feel ashamed that, you know, to have him as leader of the party.
I do think that's a shame, because I think this election is so much more than the leader. Of course, the leader is the focal point, but I think you need to look at the policies as well. So if Paul, for example, is saying he's uninspiring, and that's fine, everyone has their personal opinion of people.
But it's not very inspiring to have a passionate anti-nuclear man sort of unable to have his party agree with him, futilely sort of fighting at Labour conferences and just being prisoner to a pro-nuclear party. It's really not quite inspiring seeing the ideologue reined in, surely.
I disagree with you there. I believe that is a strength of his leadership, that he has been willing to make he's willing to compromise with the party on key messages which he knows is in the best interest of the people in this country, and I think that's a real strength, that he shows that no matter what his personal beliefs may be, that he is willing to put them aside for the greater good of the party and the greater good of the constituency and the country.
Of course, but the end result with the manifesto, I mean, surely it just means he's basically Ed Miliband with a beard.
Oh, I disagree. I mean, I saw a quote that suggested that this was a sort of manifesto that Ed Miliband wished he'd put forward. I think this is a bold, progressive, compassionate manifesto which offers a real alternative to austerity, and I think this is going down brilliantly with the electorate.
Interesting, okay, because then obviously one manifesto that doesn't seem to have gone down too well with the electorate is the Conservative one, and obviously I know naturally you would agree with me and say, my God, it's terrible, you know, sort of a wrong plan for Britain and all that, but I wanted to explore one thing with you, which is, I remember hearing that the Conservatives, they're jolly keen on Westmorland and Lonsdale because they want to, you know, have a surprise decapitation of Liberal Democrats to really throw money at it, get rid of Tim Farron, hopefully, and that'll be the surprise on the election night. I mean, are you detecting, you know, despite the atrocious social care, you know, dementia tax is a muck up, that they, that, you know, are you seeing lots of money and sort of a really huge Conservative campaign there?
I mean, the Conservatives do have that financial muscle that other parties do not. So, without a doubt, you are seeing a bit more of activity in terms of free post stuff coming through the letterbox from the Conservatives. But in terms of actually that they're campaigning, it's been as understated as it always has been. I think they do rely on a silent support as such within the constituency. Hmm. And I don't think that the candidate they've put forward is anything special. Last night at a debate we all attended, he spent half a night defending his use of the word housewife, and instead of trying to get a Conservative message across, and he really missed a trick.
He's
in that
sort
sense
of country old fogey style of Tory, is he? Sort of.
He is. He's very classic Conservative. It's probably the right wing of the party, I would say, and I don't think that is appealing to what you consider perhaps a soft Lib Dem who votes Liberal Democrat because they think Farron's all right but could be convinced to vote Tory. I don't think he's reaching out to those people.
I
do believe that this seat on June 9th will be Liberal Democrat, but I do believe that the Labour Party can have a huge influence around here.
That's interesting, but obviously I know one of the reasons why the constituency campaigning is rather famous online as well is because you've also got fierce opposition from an independent candidate, Mr. Fishfinger, am I right in thinking?
Mr. Fishfinger, allegedly. I mean, I haven't heard from him.
Have you seen him around?
I haven't, no, but he hasn't turned up to any of the events he's been offered for. I think that this is just some bloke having a bit of a giggle. And it is very funny. I mean, the Twitter poll that 99% or whatever it was suggested that Fishfinger was better than being Prime Minister than Tim Farron is indicative of perhaps Mr. Farron's wider appeal in the country. But no, I haven't seen him about. He has a fairly active Twitter account, which is thinly veiled as a Conservative campaign.
I mean,
really,
I'm sure he's going to be battered on June the 8th. We know that. Now, if I can ask about one thing, sorry to sort of make this very personal now. Are you still, at the time as we're talking, 18 years old?
I am 18, yes.
My gosh. Well, you know, sort of, what's possessed you then to sort of chuck your hat in and go for Parliament? Sort of, why are you, it's so young, and, you know, student politicians, people always think they're very sort of interesting creatures, you know, so why are you trying to have a tilt now?
Well, I think I've been involved in politics with a small P for a very long time, getting young people involved and engaged in politics.
Yes.
In the sort of the centre of the constituency in Kendal, I ran a festival getting young people engaged in voting and ran sessions on democracy and had a sort of question time style debate and getting those people engaged and registered to vote and all that. And that work there has kind of moved me forward into the Labour Party in the aftermath of the 2015 election. Mm. I was really disappointed that Labour didn't win. I think deep down I expected them to win, and there was a deep sort of desire that I didn't want that to happen again. I didn't want to have another defeat, and I wanted to do something about it. So I joined the Labour Party for that reason, and worked my way through it, all knocking, canvassing on the streets. I was, you know, then the youth officer, and I sit on the fundraising and campaign committee in the party. And when this opportunity came up, when Theresa May called the general election, and I thought I should just put my name forward. I mean, this is an area that I care passionately about, and I don't want to see a National Health Service that I was born in get destroyed, and I don't want to see I don't want to see the education services, which I'm still in right now, to get decimated, because I'm seeing the effects of that firsthand, and I know how hard it is for teachers under the stress of it all, and I know how much my school right now is going to be facing cuts.
Are you able to be campaigning full time though amid your studies, or are you sort of balancing it quite nicely?
I'm balancing it in the same way that the Conservative candidate is balancing his farming, and the same way as Farron will be balancing his leadership role. It's all relative. The way that the campaign works is I know that I have
I've got a couple hours of door knocking here, a meeting to go to, this and that, and I can kind of structure it into a sort of a timetable. So it's working really well.
All right,
in that sense.
Well, in that case, I mean, I know, if I can ask one final question, obviously Labour, with Momentum and the sort of Corbynites, they've really enthused, you could say, the grassroots. So, I mean, what's your pitch to young people, in a sense, when they want to get involved in politics? You know, what would you be saying then? Why should they get involved and, you know, maybe even stand in the next election?
So we've had 7 years of young people, for lack of a better word, getting shafted by our government. We've seen tuition fees being trebled. We've had our 18 to 21 housing benefits scrapped, our EMA taken away completely. And this is because there's no young people representing us. There is a huge apathy amongst young people. There was a huge apathy amongst young people and in towards politics. And I think Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party as a whole has energised that. Their policies have infused me, and I know they've infused many people. And around my school, around my constituency, I've got young people coming up to me and telling me that they're going to be voting Labour, they're going to be voting for the first time, and they will be voting Labour, because Labour are the only party that are offering a manifesto which benefits and helps young people. So people, young people getting involved, and getting just get your voice heard. It doesn't matter what political party you stand for, whether you're a Conservative, whether you're Mr. Fishfinger, as long as you're a young person, you want to get involved and want to have your voice heard, you should do that, because it is so important that young people get their voice heard, so we've got representation on the biggest stage.
All right, well then, thank you so much for spending the time, Eli, and good luck on the campaign.
Thank you very much. Have a lovely day.
Goodbye now. And that was Eli Aldridge, the man who is taking on Tim Farron for the Labour Party. And so we shall see how he does in, I think, a few weeks. And it'll be a very interesting result to watch, needless to say. Now, coming up next is our studio debate on the manifestos put forward by the political parties. We'll be welcoming Jacob Furedi, Leonie Cooper and Laura Round to the studio to answer the question, who has the best manifesto for Britain? But first, here are some more examples of how the party leaders have been trying to get your vote.
Labour will boost the wages of 5.7 million people earning less than the living wage to £10 an hour by 2020. Labour will end the cuts in the National Health Service and deliver safe staffing levels and reduce waiting lists. Labour will scrap tuition fees. Labour is guaranteeing the triple lock to protect pensioners' incomes. And we will build over 1 million new homes. And we make no apology for finding the resources to hire 10,000 new police officers and 3,000 new firefighters.
The government I lead will build a Britain in which work pays, with a higher national living wage. Why the government I lead will keep taxes low and cap rip-off energy tariffs. Why we will help those struggling to afford a home of their own by building more affordable homes. It's why the government I lead will build a Britain in which the economy is strong to support world-class public services with the most ambitious programme of investment in technology and buildings the NHS has ever seen. Record and fair funding for schools and the first ever proper plan to pay for and provide social care.
I want you to change Britain's future. I want you to imagine a brighter future. Imagine a future where our children can grow up in a country where people are decent to each other, where we have good schools and hospitals, where we take the challenge of climate change seriously, where we give our teachers and our nurses and our soldiers the pay rise they deserve for the service they give to our country, where we have an open, innovative economy, where we treat the poorest and the most vulnerable with compassion.
More police, more soldiers, more prison officers and more border guards are essential. There are many other things in our manifesto today. 11 billion a year spending increase for the NHS and adult social care by the end of the next parliament. That increase matches the reduction we are pledged to make in foreign aid spending. Action is required on multiple fronts, and I am proud UKIP is setting out its patriotic agenda.
Now, welcome back. So for this week's topic, the debate is manifestos. And so we'll be answering the question, who has the best manifesto for Britain? And so I had the pleasure to welcome to the studio the following. Leonie Cooper, a Labour London Assembly member. Hello.
Hi.
And as well, from the think tank Bright Blue, which is one of the premier progressive think tank, Laura Round, head of comms. Hello. And Jacob Furedi, a journalist. I don't know why I'm sort of bending over in the studio. There's a motion to people, obviously. But, you know, the webcam is going to have great fun with that. Jacob, hello again. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Now, so to kick off, of course, we have Jeremy Corbyn, you know, really getting the campaign going for Labour with sort of his speech saying, you know, all wars are wrong. You know, this is why the Manchester attacks happened, in a sense. I mean, it's bold stuff. I mean, would you say this sort of it was similarly bold just as the manifesto was then, Leonie?
I'd say that's
pretty bold, and I would say that the manifesto was also really bold, coming back to what we're mainly talking about today. I think there's some really interesting things in it and some really strong pledges. I particularly like the anti-fracking pledge. As you know, I'm the chair of the Environment Committee, so I'm very keen to look at the all the environmental pledges and also on housing as well.
Interesting. And then would you agree with that, sort of, Laura, that it was good, like, nice stuff from the environment?
It was definitely... Oh, on the environment?
Yes.
Well, I think they did tackle environment issues, which is a positive. I think all parties should do so. And I think to a certain extent they all did, increasingly so over our last manifestos. But the more the better.
Because I know Bright Blue's done a lot on sort of pushing the importance of, you know, green technology, and this has been a sort of a thing that maybe the Tory party hasn't quite listened to so much because they think of it as sort of prohibitive red tape, in that sense.
No, you're right. Our research recently shows that actually the majority of Conservative voters in 2015 care very deeply about environment issues. And the Conservative manifesto does tackle it. It recognises that it is a part of a Conservative philosophy, and they've put some big ambitions in there.
Of course. And then, Jacob, I mean, how are you finding the manifestos from your perspective? I mean, I imagine UKIP or Conservative are the best, and you're most inspirational.
I wouldn't push it, Asa. Basically, I'll throw my colours out there as far as I'll say that I am as Brexiter as they come. Which is why I do find, you know, these manifestos very interesting. For me, this election, no matter what all these policies coming out of these manifestos are, this is the Brexit election. There's only one major issue confronting us when we go to the polling station. And so that question just comes down to is whether we respect democracy or not. So when you go down to the polling station, I think that rather than, you know, voting for a number of reasons, I think the most important thing you can do is if you respect democracy, you can respect, you know, the will of the people. And it's actually really interesting that, you know, a recent poll showed that 68% of the UK is now supporting Brexit, is to go down and support for the most Brexit-supporting candidate. This is the Brexit election, not an election on housing.
Interesting. So, Leonie, if we say it's a Brexit election, is the best way of respecting democracy voting Labour? How do you respect the result there?
Yeah, well, I think, Jacob, with all due respect, that is complete nonsense. And three of the parties have made it clear that they completely respect the democratic vote that we had on the 23rd of June. Labour voted in the main most people for triggering Article 50 and has said it respects the democratic outcome on the 23rd. It's only the Greens and the Liberal Democrats who are saying, oh, we want another referendum and all that nonsense. So I think go to the manifestos and look at the policies, Asa, to see whether you really think that the Labour manifesto has got the best things in it as well as respecting democracy. And that's where, you know, I'm very happy to start there and very, very keen. I really don't like the stuff on fracking the hell out of everywhere, which is what the Conservatives are suggesting in their manifesto. Oh, right. Really bad policy.
But then what would you say to that, Jacob?
Yeah. I just want to come back on that. I think I'd be very interested to know if you've had any recent conversations with a number of your MPs, David Lammy in particular, Chukwu Muna, who have really actually come out against the Brexit vote and kind of, and even, you know, your own Diane Abbott and Emily Thornberry have really demonised Brexit voters since the kind of the referendum. So, you know, displaying Labour as a Brexit supporting party is, you know, it's laughable. The fact that it doesn't even endorse this notion of, I really push back against this notion of a soft Brexit and a hard Brexit. I think we just have a Brexit. And I actually think that, you know, I don't support all of their policies, but to give credit to the Conservative manifesto, they are saying that we are going to leave the customs union and the single market, which I think is really important. I think we're going to respect the will of the people. We're going to respect the vote last June. We have to put in our manifestos that we're going to leave the EU in its entirety. And I think that any kind of statement otherwise is as anti-democrat as they come.
What would you say to that, Laura?
Well, firstly, I was not a Brexiteer, but I do agree with Jacob that this probably is very much an election on Brexit. Leonie is right. Nearly all the major parties are accepting Brexit. But what matters post this election is who's going to be the Prime Minister seeing us through Brexit and the negotiations. And in my mind, there's only one capable candidate, and I'd be mildly terrified if it was the other candidate.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, Doyle, you can mention the candidates here. I mean, we don't have to worry about the sort of regulations.
I'd be terrified of Corbyn.
Sort of, you know, whether we are. Sort of, but I couldn't help imagining, being intrigued when you were saying you weren't a, you know, Brexit supporter during the campaign, because obviously the Tory manifesto, it now explicitly says, you know, we will be leaving the single market and the customs union. So it commits the Tory party to a hard Brexit. Now, this may seem very very technocratic for listeners, I do apologise, but during the last few years, Anna Soubry, Nicky Morgan, the sort of remainers in the Tory party, have been able to use a get-out clause for justifying their concerns of saying, you know, I stood in the manifesto saying we'll stay in the single market. So are you kind of happy with the way the Tory party is going on this?
It obviously takes some adjusting too.
You're having sleepless nights, aren't
you? No, I'm not having sleepless nights anymore. I definitely did at the start. I think when Theresa May did her Lancaster House speech, it actually became quite evident that that was probably the only solution if we accept that freedom of movement is not something the public want, which is also what Bright Blue research kind of demonstrates. So realistically, having both, you know, having your cake and eating it is just is not going to hold up. And she says she's talked to all the leaders in the other 27 European states, and they've made that very clear. So I think that's sort of understandable.
And Nisht, if I could take up your point on free movement with Leonie. Now, the evolution of the Labour manifesto was interesting, and obviously we can talk about that because there was a leak of the draft one, and then we saw the curious line inserted in after the Clause, I think, 5 meeting, you know, that there will be an end to free movement. So, I mean, do you think the Labour's robust enough on immigration, or is there a kind of a rift between the London Labourites and the kind of ones worrying about the North and what people think up there?
I mean, I think the problem is that when we're talking about freedom of movement, everybody only wants the people to come into the country who might be useful and helpful.
Yes.
And nobody wants anyone to come in who might not be useful and helpful. And it's where you draw the line around what is useful and helpful. And I think that's where a lot of politicians have got themselves into a lot of hot water. Members of the public, I think, have been very clear that having a very large number of people arriving in small towns or villages who all speak a different language and haven't, you know, when their children first come into school, you know, they're all speaking another language, they have found that a very uncomfortable process. But we went through situations like this where people felt very unhappy during the 50s and 60s, and, you know, you could see the signs in windows apparently that said, you know, no blacks, no dogs, no Irish. We've moved way beyond that now, and I think we are at this moment in time in that period just after a whole set of new people have arrived in this country, many of whom are really productive. And I think in 10 years' time, we will have moved beyond some of the concerns that a lot of people have now, which are quite rightful concerns, but we can move beyond them because we've shown that in the past.
But then how is Labour hoping to address these concerns?
I think talking about not having a hard Brexit and having one that allows for business to thrive in London, which, you know, people can say what they like about being London-centric or, you know, the metropolitan elite and all the rest of it, but, you know, we bailed out a lot of the banks in 2007-08 for the reason that, you know, London has often been the motor of the economy. So to make sure we've got the right people here, I think what Sadiq has been saying and what we've been saying about staying in the single market and the customs union is quite correct.
So then, Jacob, do you have bad news for her on that?
Well, I mean, I completely push back against this notion of staying in the single market as being a progressive measure. I mean, there's nothing more...
Although, can I just jump in? We're not trying to debate the measure necessarily, no. From the manifesto.
For the manifesto. Okay, yeah. Well, I'll take you up on your point about immigration, which I think is actually a really crucial point to be had. And I think... I actually think that Labour has a worrying... Although Labour, in their manifestos, I think, you know, Corbyn rightly didn't put a number on a certain cap, which I think was a wise decision, whereas, you know, Theresa May did put that figure on it. I do would push back. I mean, Labour have a history of, you know, actually, they'd like to present themselves as a progressive party, but their view on immigration is slightly worrying. You look back at 2015 at the classic, you know, immigration mug, which didn't exactly go down a storm. Labour like to present themselves as the happy-clappy party in terms of immigration, but actually I think they're equally culpable of being the nasty party in this respect.
Leonie, did you buy one of those mugs? Controls on immigration.
Didn't buy any of those mugs from the 2015 general election. I didn't feel the need for additional mugs to clutter up my
not someone for
kitchen.
Merchandise, I guess. You know, sort
no,
of.
I've got mugs with cats on. Sorry, Ace.
No, it's all right. That's fine. Well, maybe you have one with, you know, sort of Jeremy's face on it or something in the new era.
Or Jeremy's cat.
El Gato, indeed.
Yeah. I've got one with Jeremy Corbyn's face on it next to Sadiq, I think, saying trouble brewing.
Let's move away from mugs to manifestos. The final question, if I might, which obviously I could talk about mugs for a whole hour at this rate, but Laura, obviously with the Tory manifesto, to kind of sum up, naturally, you know, the general consensus for this election seems to have been, you know, OK, well, Labour's just trying to mitigate the Tory majority. It's all just, you know, damage mitigation in a sense. Mm. And then Tories have dropped an absolute clanger over the last week or so, given the 23-point poll lead. It was almost embarrassing how far ahead they were. Now it's 5-point lead. It's a social, you know, the hashtag dementia tax has done it in a sense. Have they just royally screwed this up with their manifesto?
Well, I don't think so. I think it was a very bold and progressive and welcome policy. I mean, there's some arguments to be made about how it was, you know, explained, and maybe it wasn't explained properly enough because it is very complex. But I think it was a very welcome and surprising policy. You've got the Conservative Party, who people would expect to just be, you know, bringing in policies that would sit well with the older generations, which they kind of assume will vote Conservative. Instead, they're making the bold choice of scrapping a triple lock and actually
tackling
social care.
But then they panicked and now tacking on a care cap when 3 days later people don't like it. It's not really a... I mean, it makes Labour's manifesto process look highly stable and well thought out in a sense, you know, whereas it's just...
The U-turn or sort of the amendment to the policy.
Well,
you
I mean,
mean,
yeah. But even then...
I think the cap is a welcome addition.
Fine, all right. Well, that's sort of good, solid news, some news, I mean, I imagine. Obviously, I fear we could have a whole new debate erupt in a sense, you know, for the rest of the show, so I might have to draw it to a close there. But nonetheless, thank you so much, Leonie, Laura and Jacob, for your time.
Thank you.
And needless to say, I can tell you what, we've got one last thing, obviously, after the break. Coming up next, I'll be speaking to Liberal Democrats Caroline Pidgeon. Politics on FUBAR will be straight back with you after this short break.
FUBAR Radio presents Sarah Love
and My Sticky by Jafar and Nkechi.
Hello. Yeah, hi.
I heard on the grapevine that you were going to kick us some spoken word for us.
Saki's ass was everything like the sun. It was big, it was bold, it was a celestial body rising to contour South Africa's coast. It was a ledge to stand on and gaze into the face of heaven's host.
Lovely!
Every Monday,
Sarah Love and My Sticky.
From 4 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio presents Politics on FUBAR.
And welcome back. It's Asa Bennett here. And now, last but certainly not least, I have the pleasure to introduce Caroline Pidgeon, Liberal Democrat, London Assembly member. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Asa.
Now, how are you today? Are you enjoying the sort of return to politics, manifestos, policy? We can finally chew that over.
Yeah, absolutely. But obviously, you know, we can't just push to one side all those people who tragically lost their lives. And I think it's right that we had a couple of days just pausing in the manic nature of campaigning to reflect on the tragedy that happened.
Definitely. I mean, obviously, London is... I'm sure there are lots of serious conversations going on in City Hall about how to make sure London is as secure as it can be in that sense, you know, sort of given the horror.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in terms of resourcing for policing and also investment in terms of programs with young people, it's really, really important that that starts to be looked at in light of what's happened and how we can reach young people in different communities.
I mean, obviously, this maybe sound a bit counterintuitive, but given UKIP, rather shamelessly, if I may say, yesterday, you know, piggybacked on Manchester to say, oh, you know, we need to be tougher on Islam and, you know, stronger on crime and all this sort of stuff. If I could flip it on its head slightly, what will the Liberal Democrats do then in light of, you know, to sort of on the counter-extremism, how to keep Britain safe? What would your party pledge?
Well, I mean, one key thing, and I talk to counter-terrorist police regularly as I sit on the Police and Crime Committee at City Hall, one of the key things is we've got to see investment in community policing. We've got to make sure we've got the police and the PCSOs on the ground talking to communities, and we get so much intelligence from those police and PCSOs that feeds into counter-terrorism. But alongside that, we would want to see investment in youth services. I personally think the PREVENT programme needs to be refreshed. It needs to be much more localised rather than run from Whitehall. And those are some of the sorts of things that we would be looking at. But, you know, we saw what happened when we brought UKIP were doing yesterday. You know, our view is you don't have to accept Theresa May and Nigel Farage's kind of extreme version of Brexit. They're sort of perhaps extreme views in certain areas.
Oh, no, we can go on to Brexit shortly. I'm just thinking about security.
Yeah, but just... but. UKIP are all about.
Yes.
Not just playing on fears of people who are different, but also playing on the issue of Brexit. And I think, you know, people don't have to accept that as the only option on the 8th of June.
I mean, obviously with these sort of security arrangements, it's you know, funny because obviously UKIP then they were still using that to do the return to their base instincts, perhaps, and still go on about Islam and all the rest. And I think there are assembly members of yours who do, like David Curtin and Peter Whittle, I think, who are practically obsessed about it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think they have an unhealthy obsession with a number of issues. And when I go out talking on the doorsteps, people are not coming up with those issues. They're talking about the NHS. They're talking about Brexit and the impact that's going to have on their families. They're talking about housing and the housing crisis we have in the capital. You know, they're not talking about some of these issues that UKIP seem to be obsessed by.
But then obviously, if we go back to the bread and butter, I think, of the Liberal Democrat campaign, which, as you were alluding to, is the you know, opposition to a hard Brexit. Do you think, I mean, is the campaign really taking off, do you think?
Well, I think on the doorsteps and in particular areas of London, people are really concerned about Brexit. It's going to have a huge impact on jobs in London. We're going to see thousands of jobs moving to the continent. We're already starting to see that. But also it's about opportunities for young people. And we felt as a party that 16 and 17 year olds should have had a vote in the referendum. They did in the Scottish one. And we continue to believe that 16 and 17 year olds should have the right to vote. And it's quite clear young people voted overwhelmingly to remain in the European Union. And the older generations perhaps voted to leave. And that is something that I think, you know, the younger generation will increasingly resent, the opportunities that being a member of the EU has in terms of being able to travel around 27 member states freely, to be able to go and live and work and study. You know, all these opportunities will be taken away as a result of this Brexit vote.
Okay, and then the party, your party wants to have a second referendum at the end, once the terms of the deal are negotiated. But then doesn't that not, is there not a second vote already happening called the general election on?
Well, no. I mean, the general election is about Brexit. It's about other issues. It's about the state of our country and how it's being squeezed. But we're the only party that's made, from word go, saying we believe that you should have the final say on whether the Brexit deal that's negotiated is right for you and your family in a referendum. If it's right for the people to have a say on whether to leave the EU, we should look at the deal and put it on the table and say, you vote for this or we remain in the European Union. And I think it's right that we give that back to the people rather than bureaucrats and politicians stitching up a deal which will not be, I'm sure, what many people had voted for.
But then obviously, I'm sure Brexiteer listeners tuning in will be wanting me to ask this question, of course. If the result was the other way around, sort of 52 remain, 48 leave, you know, would you be then insistent in this alternative universe that no, there cannot be a second referendum, you know, in the fewest time? We are remain means remain.
No, I think, you know, if it had been that close, I'm sure there would be moves for a second referendum, as we're seeing in Scotland. And I think that is something that down the line we would have had to have had, or perhaps the government would have been mandated to make certain changes if they had come out in the campaign. But because this is specifically what our exit deal is, people were very clear the destination, they wanted to leave the EU. Some wanted to stay in the single market. Some people, you know, had different views on what it would mean. We should put that to the British people and have the confidence in them to make that final decision.
Of course. And then naturally there was a very much a big demonstration of how you struck a nerve in Richmond Park. I think it was in December when you ousted Zach Goldsmith and Sarah Olney became your newest recruit in Parliament. Of course, do you fear that then she might lose her seat to the Conservatives given how far ahead in the polls they are?
Look, we're fighting for every vote we can across London and particularly in some of our target seats even more so. But every vote for the Liberal Democrats really helps support our parliamentary party in being a real opposition and putting strong views across and challenging the government. You know, it's going to be a Tories landslide. That is absolutely clear. And what I think is you need a strong opposition, and that's what the Liberal Democrats have been so far and will continue to be given that voice and that mandate in Parliament.
Now, if I could just pick you up there, of course, on the Tory landslide. I'm sure you've seen the YouGov poll today showing that the Tories now only 5 points ahead of Labour, which, if that happened, obviously would put us in hung Parliament territory, with Tories just 2 seats ahead, the majority shrivelled. So, you know, let's play this scenario. I mean, How do you think Liberal Democrats should move in such a coalition negotiation? Would they?
Well, it's very clear in our manifesto, and Tim Farron, our leader, has made it very clear that the Liberal Democrats will not go into a coalition with Labour or the Conservatives after the next election, because they have supported Brexit and we don't, and so we would not go into coalition with them. But I do not believe those polls. I'm out in seats all across the capital as a London-wide member, and I talk to friends in all parties across the country. It is going to be a Conservative landslide, and that's why you can afford to vote Liberal Democrat, because your vote will really matter and give our parliamentarians a strong voice in the next Parliament opposing the Conservative plans.
Interesting. I mean, why do you think then, as someone who's a seasoned poll watcher, I imagine, over your time, why do you think they've showed a sort of uplift for Labour then?
Well, you know, I can't predict the polls, and if we recall the last election, the polls were completely wrong, so I wouldn't say I have faith in them. I just go by my gut instinct when I'm out talking to people. You know, yes, things like the dementia tax, that will have had some impact, of course, on Conservatives, and Liberal Democrats are the only party putting forward very clear plans to fund the NHS and social care going forward by putting a penny on income tax. Really honest policies, being very clear. If you want quality health services, if we want social care that allows people as they're getting older to have the support they need, then it's got to be funded. And we're saying that should come through income tax, and we put a penny on income tax. And also to support mental health services,
yes,
put them on a parity. They are such a Cinderella service. Yet one in four of your listeners will have a mental health problem at some point in their life. We need to make sure those services are there for when people need them.
No, that's very, definitely very, very true. But then, if we can look ahead to the election, of course, I mean, how obviously you've been going out the doorstep, you know, far better than I would, how voters are feeling. What's your take on, you know, how ambitious are you feeling about the Liberal Democrats? Will they get into double figures in terms of MPs?
I would hope so. I think we could well double the seats we currently have in Parliament. You know, we took a big hit last time, and people are slowly getting their confidence back in us. They like our policies, and it's making sure they have the confidence to vote for us. But when we've got some fantastic former MPs re-standing, Vince Cable down in Twickenham, Simon Hughes in Bermondsey, these are people who were trusted for many years by their communities. We were punished last time. But I have no doubt that more and more people will be going out to vote for them, and I hope we'll see them re-elected on the 9th of June.
All right. And then a final question, if I might just squeeze this in, of course. The local elections weren't exactly very pretty for the Liberal Democrats. So, you know, will there be many surprises on the night? And if so, where would be your tips in terms of seats?
Well, I mean, the local elections across the country, they varied. You saw places like Eastleigh, which we had held the parliamentary seat as well as the council for many years, gaining every seat that was up for grabs on that day, including from parties like UKIP, places like Cheltenham as well. So I think, you know, in some seats where we have had MPs before, we hopefully will start to see some gains there. But, you know, I'm not under any illusion we're suddenly going to have hundreds and hundreds of MPs, but I would hope that we'll be able to at least double the number we have at the moment.
Of course, the day that there will be hundreds and hundreds of Liberal Democrat MPs, I'm sure, you know, maybe you'll be among them, perhaps.
You never know.
We shall definitely see. But thank you so much for your time, Caroline. And
pleasure.
Have a good afternoon.
Nice to talk to you. And you. Bye-bye.
And so that was Caroline Pidgeon, Liberal Democrat London Assembly member. Now, we've been running a Twitter poll in the meantime, obviously talking about asking the key question of who is the best manifesto for Britain. And the results have been coming in, and my gosh, it is a landslide. Not for the Conservatives. I mean, sorry about that, Theresa May. It's very much for Labour. 75% of you think Labour has the best manifesto. Jeremy Corbyn will be jolly pleased with himself. And, you know, only 25% for Corbyn. The Liberal Democrats, I mean, Caroline, if she was still listening, would be very sad to hear... It seems nothing. Oh, well, you know, still, it's been, you know, good news otherwise, all the same, to be able to take you through the show. And thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. Obviously, it leaves me just to say one thing simply. It's been a pleasure to host this. Goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.
This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.